If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store. On 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
We are inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley. My name is Jake Query. Mike Thompson, the other voice you hear on this program, Landon Coons, is our producer. And Mike, we are getting closer and closer and closer. And if you look down at your arm, the hair might be starting to stand up just a little bit, because it will not be long now before we hear the roar of the engines of the 110th running of the Indianapolis 500.
Yeah, I'm ready to go. Let's just do it now. What do you think?
We have to get the people inside the venue first off.
Oh, right? That's right. And then there's all these logistical things, right?
And those logistics include all that goes into simply starting the race. Like, for example, some of the chief starters of the Indianapolis 500. That is our initial subject matter tonight as we talk about the names, the personalities, the stories, and hear some of the audio of the stars of yesteryear in the founding and the building of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Again, tonight we spotlight some of the chief starters of the greatest race in the world. The first chief starter of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway was a gentleman who was in the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Hall of Fame, formerly known as the Auto Racing Hall of Fame, and fairly well known in the early days of racing. But Fred Wagner had an extremely short career within the venue at 16th in Georgetown. The Speedway historian emeritus, Donald Davidson, explains exactly why.
The first two, 1911, 1912, was Fred Pop Wagner, who didn't get along with Carl Fisher very well, and he flagged the 1909 Crushed Rock and Tour races and the 1910s, and then 11 and 12, and then I think that was it. So he did just Pop Wagner for the first couple of years.
Mike, the reality, there were several people like Fred Wagner who were involved in the early years of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Yeah, and it's interesting about Fred Wagner himself, because he was actually pretty well known. I mean, how Pat Vidan, we'll talk about Pat Vidan later in the show. Pat Vidan was very well known, obviously. Fred Wagner was a pretty big name at the early stages of auto racing. I mean, he actually put out a book called The Saga of the Roaring Road that you can still find on bookshelves. And so he was a pretty big name. So for the fact that he and Carl Fisher, you know, didn't get along and was actually out after 2 years, I found that story a little interesting, actually.
And there were a lot of folks who flagged the race in the subsequent years after Fred, before the next well-known name took over the duties. Here is Donald Davidson on the tenure of Seth Klein.
Okay, Seth Klein was the chief starter pretty much from 1925 until 1953. And why I say pretty much was they would name an honorary starter. And sometimes they stayed up for the whole event, and sometimes they didn't. And sometimes it was a friend of Rickenbacker's. But for most of the time, Seth Klein did the job alone. In fact, actually, in 1938, this is a little trivia, the green flag at the start was waved by Tazio Nuvolari, the Italian driver that was a hero to Eddie Sachs, which is another story that I don't have time to tell. But Seth Klein was from, golly, now I knew his brother, Bill Klein, who was very heavily involved with the Old Timers Club. And were they from Columbus? Or Franklin. Maybe it was Franklin. It was south of Indianapolis, but not too far south. And anyway, Seth Klein was a big man, tall and big. and didn't have a particular flair. I mean, it wasn't Bill Vandewater or Pat Badan who had a real flair for the showmanship. But anyway, he was the starter for quite some time. Well, it was 1925 through 1953. And then he announced his retirement. And I think he was going to buy a Dairy Queen and move to Florida or something like that. And then he passed away not too long after that. But there was actually one of the rumors when the track was during the war, the place was overgrowing and would it be revived after the war, that one of the different versions was that I think Rickenbacker was going to continue owning it and that Seth Klein would run it. But that's one of a number of plans that never came to pass.
Mike, interesting, when we talk about anniversary years on this program on Beyond the Bricks, you know, we often make note of listening to a race from 20 years ago, 30 years ago, etc. We have sound tonight from 75 years ago, and it is rare sound that you came up with from the Columbia Club in downtown Indianapolis.
Yeah, that's correct. We actually have a rare interview with Seth Klein, which I think is kind of cool. It's neat to hear from these figures because some of these names are kind of remote figures. Later on, we're going to talk about Bill Vandewater and some of these people. But like Seth Klein, I mean, you hear the name Seth Klein, but you haven't heard anything from him. So tonight we actually have a rare interview we can play for you. This is from the BorgWarner party that was at the Columbia Club the night before the race in 1951. Sid Collins did a live kind of like question and answer situation for the Mutual Broadcast System that aired nationwide. And one of the people he interviewed briefly was Seth Klein.
Now here's the man who bills himself as the man who has the busiest job in the world on Memorial Day. He's the traffic cop on the world's busiest street.
Seven Flag Street.
On Seven Flag Street, Mr. Seth Klein.
And I want to start out by going out on a limb as usual.
All right, Seth.
All the drivers have predicted speeds around 126 miles an hour. I want to say that if the race goes 500 miles, the average will be between 123 and 124 miles an hour.
Well, Seth, about the young drivers in the track, I know you've had lots of talks with them. What kind of instructions do you give the new rookie drivers who haven't driven here at Indianapolis before?
Well, we try to be very careful. And this year's crop of new drivers is outstanding. They listen, and we believe that they pay attention. And I want to tell an amusing incident that's happened this afternoon.
Go ahead, Seth, please.
Faulkner, who broke the record last year in qualifying and again this year, after the regular meeting came up and said, Seth, could I attend your rookie meeting again this year?
Well, he's a boy who certainly knows a lot about racing.
That's right, and look out for him tomorrow.
He's a good boy to watch. In fact, we have lots of good boys in the
field
tomorrow.
That's right, only 33 that I can think of.
That's right. Seth, thanks very much. You're doing a wonderful job. And how many years have you been out there as chief
starter? Since 1920.
Well, you certainly know your business, and I know you're going to wave those checkered socks at him if you lose the checkered flag.
That's right.
Right, thanks very much. Seth Klein, the chief starter here at the Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Following Seth Klein and his departure, a gentleman aforementioned, Bill Vandewater, took over the responsibilities as the chief starter. Donald Davidson with more on Vandewater.
From 54 until 61, it was Bill Vandewater. And who in 1954, and he was a great showman, just like Pat Badan, who followed him. And Bill Vandewater endeared himself to anyone that wasn't familiar with his work because he, like Pat, would drop to one knee to and flag from the track. And the 1954 closing stages was that Bill Vukovich, on his way to winning for the second straight year, just didn't back off in the closing laps, which he could have. And Jimmy Bryan, who was struggling with a dirt car, and I think the right rear shock had broken, and he was taking a terrible pounding and dropping further back. And it ended up that Vukovich took the checkered flag, actually lapping Jimmy Bryan. And to the amazement of some and the adulation of others, Bill Vandewater was actually on his knee with the checkered with one hand and the white with the other, because Bryan still had another lap to go. But anyway, so Bill Vandewater from Chicago from 54 to 61, so he flagged Foyt and kind of little ironic here that that his final year was the last year for the bricks on the main straightaway. He took ill late summer, and he actually passed away.
Mike, what's interesting is how some of the chief starters can bridge together some of the great drivers or eras of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And I think we kind of see that when you really take a look at the tenure, if you will, of Vandewater, and then going into his successor, Pat Badan, and some of the great names that are thus linked when looking at the lineage of those starters.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, Bill Vandewater, in his first 500 as the chief starter, he flagged Bill Vukovich home as the winner. In his final 500, he flagged home A.J. Foyt. So really kind of an interesting, you know, couple of drivers there that he flagged home as the victor of the 500. So you're right. I mean, when you look at the tenures, it's really kind of cool to see how they bridge the gap in different eras and different driving styles and different cars. Obviously, we're starting to see the Roadster era, obviously, for Bill Vandewater, and then later on from Pat Badan, we're going to go from the Roadster era all the way to rear engine cars and ground effects.
Here is Donald Davidson on the great Pat Badan.
Pat Badan was the chief starter for the Indianapolis 500 from 1962 until 1979. His first year at the track was 1958, and he had served as the assistant starter. He was from Portland, Oregon. He was a health expert. He was a weightlifter and numerous other things, which I'll get into in a few moments. But he went down to, in 1957, USAC had a series of races in Florida during the winter. I think there was 8 races, midgets, and they called it the Tangerine Tournament. And down there, Pat Badan went to flag the thing, and he met Tony Holman, and the next thing, he was up here in the next year serving as an assistant starter. And then when Bill Vandewater, who was the from Chicago, was the starter from 54, he became ill and in 1961, and in early 62, he passed away, and so Pat was elevated to chief starter. He was a great showman, always very snazzily dressed. He wore black pants, two-tone shoes. They were black, but the part over the toes was white, and he wore a white jacket, always spotless. And he liked to flag from the track, and what he would do was to do like a little bit of a skip and down on one knee as he twirled the flag. And it was funny on the first qualifying day with a huge packed grandstand, especially across the way, he would go out and do a practice twirl, which I don't know that he really needed to do, but there was part of the showmanship, and he would sort of go out there at like around 8:30 and sort of flex his arms a little bit, pick up the checker, and then go down on one knee to do the twirl, and there would be this huge cheer across the way, just the same as Tom Carnegie could come on and go, click, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, testing, there, I blew that one. It was click, hum, and then 1, 2, 3, testing. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It would be this huge cheer. Anyway, back to Pat Badan. He had a health studio in Speedway for a while down on Main Street, and a lot of the drivers used to go there. And I don't know what he could press, but it was something enormous. He could do one-handed push-ups. He also played several instruments, and he had a lightning cartoon a gig that he used to do for schools and adults, and the kids loved it. And what he would do is he'd set up this easel with this large, big pad. Okay, but I mean the pages were huge, and so he would put the cover over the top of the easel so it's hanging down the back, and then flick 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 flick, and he would have a cartoon up there, and then he would turn the page and then flick flick, and he would tell a story, and he did all, you know, all these. He had like a driver that was scared, you know, because he was at the speedway the first time, and you know, realized how long the straightaways were, and he'd have, you know, eyes popping out and all that kind of stuff. And he was a very intense guy, and he always looked worried, and his eyebrows were always furrowed up.
But it doesn't mean we're done talking about Pat Vedan. On the other side, very rare audio from some 44 years ago with Pat Vedan. We'll play that for you and more when we return to Beyond the Break.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
In Indy, this is the weekend summer really starts. And at Sullivan's, we're taking an additional 10% off all premium patio furniture and 20% off umbrellas. So, get ready for summer at Sullivan's.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Welcome back inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley. Jake Query, Mike Thompson, Landon Coons. It is Beyond the Bricks. We thank all of you that are listening, whether it be on the radio stations or after the fact in podcast form. It is not only our pleasure to do this show for you, but also the interaction that we get from all of you via social media, emails, whichever way it may be. I know I speak for Mike in saying how appreciative we are of the support of this program over the number of years, which allows us to do it once again. It is a thrill and an honor to get everybody set up for and prepared for the Indianapolis 500 by taking a look back at the great personalities and history of the great facility at 16th and Georgetown. Those personalities were often featured, by the way, on Kevin Calabro's Talk from Gasoline Alley that took place in 1982. Kevin Calabro, of course, the brother of Dave Calabro, two guys that were very synonymous in that era, and still to this day to a great extent, with bringing out those personalities and letting you hear so much from them over the course of their time working out at IMS. The first hour of the show of Talk from Gasoline Alley consisted of Donald Davidson answering questions of the nostalgic nature. You can hear Donald saying that as I repeat the term. Well, the second hour was an interview segment, and we are very fortunate that Mike was able to come up with this. Mike, this is cool. In those interview segments, you went back to that 1982 year, and Mike, you found some audio from a guy we just got done talking about.
Yeah, that's correct. Again, another situation where Pat Vedan is a guy we know a lot about from the fact that he was so well known as the chief starter. But have you ever heard Pat Vedan's voice? Have you ever heard him talking? And I hadn't until I found this interview with Pat Vedan. So I thought this was really cool stuff. And I was really excited about it because I never got a chance to meet Pat Vedan, but I know Pat Vedan's daughter, Michelle. She's just a wonderful, wonderful person. And I thought it'd be really cool if we kind of dove into this interview that Pat Vedan did with Kevin Calabro in 1982.
My wife, Marilyn, and I, we've talked about it and said, we lived in Oregon originally. And we said, someday we're going to go to the 500 and see the whole thing, and if we never go back, at least we've seen it. Never dreaming, of course, that I would be a part of it. But in 57, I went to Florida, and I flagged the Tangerine Tournament all over the state of Florida and did the backflips and all that. And I got a letter from Tony Holman inviting me to the 500. And I didn't meet Mr. Holman until I got it here. I talked to Joe Quinn later on. I said, what prompted Tony to call me? He said, well, he watched you all during the race at Daytona on a quarter mile, or Miami, excuse me. And he said, there's my next starter if I can get him in the following year. I was at the 500.
But the thing was, you couldn't do your acrobatics out here, Pat. You couldn't really shine, huh?
That doesn't make me mad at all.
I bet it doesn't.
You know, Pat Vedan may be most known for his kind of acrobatic flagging, if you will, and the way that he could masterfully do the tapestry of the flags waving across the start-finish line when he would be working. But he told Kevin Calabro a story about how that got him in a little bit of trouble early in his career.
It was involving Al Keller, wasn't it?
I think so, as a matter of fact, yeah.
Well, I'd stand out in the middle of the track, and of course I'd tell the fellas all ahead of time what to do, and as they come at me single file, why, I'd give them the signal and they'd divide, and as they're dividing, I'd run towards them and do a round-off backhand spring and a full twisting back layout. and everything went fine. And then as they go by, I'd step to the side of the track, and the next time they come around, I'd give them the green flag, which I did. And Al Keller started last, and he kept dropping back, and pretty soon he pulled into the pits. And after the race, I went to him, and I says, what's the matter, Al, have trouble? Vidan, you so-and-so. I said, what did I do? He says, well, he said, I come out of number four turn, and I saw you going end for end. And I said to myself, somebody hit the so-and-so. And he says, shook me up. I didn't feel like racing, and I pulled off.
Called it quits.
Yeah.
Was that the last time you did that type of acrobatic work at a race?
Oh, no, no. I did that quite a bit, but I made sure that everybody was listening when I was talking to him. Apparently, he didn't hear me when I was telling him.
Now, Pat Vidan, Mike, was really keen on two things, one of the two of which we possess on this program, showmanship and professionalism. Now, I'm not going to let you decide which of those two it is that we have, but they were hallmarks of Vidan's career. And, Mike, the reality is two things that I think he took a lot of pride in.
Oh, he definitely took pride in both of those things, showmanship and professionalism. Showmanship is something that you and I bring to the table, I think. I hope we bring professionalism, but more, certainly more showmanship.
I have a job to do. I did it to the best of my ability, and fortunately, I made no mistakes. And I think that's because I didn't get excited. Because if you get excited, come unglued, so to speak, you don't do yourself any good, but mainly you're not doing any of the drivers any good. They depend on you, and you've got to do the right thing.
You made such a great figure up there on the stand with the white jacket and, of course, the broad shoulders, and you got the flags and the whole thing, and just fantastic. Like the caller said, it added so much there, especially if you were sitting on the main straightaway there, just to the showbiz part of it.
Well, it is part of it. You know, I could do the a lot of people say, well, why do you wear a white jacket? Well, that's so the drivers can see you. I can do the same job. I could have done the same job in a pair of Levi's, but it doesn't look very well. You know?
Kind of loses effect, doesn't
it? A little bit, yeah.
You know, Mike, the funny thing about any job is that there's always a part of any job description that people, you go through and you weather through it because then it leads to the fun part of the job. That was actually true for Pat Vidan as well. There was a part of the job, Mike, that he was not as keen on as he was being acrobatic with the flags.
Oh, there's definitely a part he didn't enjoy. And the part he didn't enjoy was when they moved him from trackside up into the flag stand. I mean, he made it very well known that he did not like that move because he couldn't do all of his acrobatic maneuvering as much up there in the flag stand. He felt it really restricted all he did. So it was pretty well known that Pat Vidan did not like the move to the flag stand.
Well, I tell you, Kevin, I would much rather work down on the edge of the track than I would up in the box there, because I've always felt that I could communicate with the drivers easier when being down low. Because, for example, if a car is coming around the track and get the report from an observer that something fell off the car and the car is pretty near to you, Well, before I could have my assistant, Tom Beasley, hold up the number of the car and I'd show the black flag, up in the tower, it's hard, and they'll be able to miss you. And of course, if they miss you, it could be serious enough that they could hang it on the wall. You don't want to see that. But being down on the edge of the track, I could hold a flag and bounce down on the track if I have to, and then poke at the driver, the particular driver, with the handle of pointing at the driver that it's meant for, and then he can get it much more readily, and this way we can prevent an accident.
Pat, why did they move you upstairs to the podium?
I really don't know.
No? When was that move made?
Oh,
just a dozen or so years ago?
It was about, I don't recall. I that thing I don't want to remember. I just didn't like it.
You had no say, though, huh?
No.
Oh, well.
During that interview with Kevin Calabro, there was a very poignant moment, and we're going to play this clip, then break it down for you afterwards. Pat Vidan talking about safety with Kevin Calabro.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Hi, you're on the air at WIBC.
When Pat Vidan said that the best years that he remembers are the ones where no one gets hurt, in light of the recent Formula One fatality of Gilles Villeneuve, I'd just like to point out that there hasn't been a fatal wreck at Indianapolis since 1973, and that's something I'm really proud of, being an Indianapolis race car fan in particular. But what I'd like to know is what actually goes through your mind when a bad wreck occurs on the track. I know when I'm sitting in the stands, and for instance, last year when Ungaeta hit the wall, and you really have no idea of what the actual circumstances of the wreck were. What goes through your mind as a flagman? You know, you obviously must be upset being close to the drivers and all that. How does that affect you when you flag the race, or do you even let it?
No, during the good Lord saw fit to make me a person who doesn't get excited, and I'm grateful for that. When something happens, I have a job to do, and I go ahead and do it to the best of my ability, hoping that they'll see my flags and that I can help them. And, of course, when it's over with, then you start thinking and wish it had never happened.
Yeah.
Now, I agree with you that there hasn't been a fatality for a long, long time, and I'm grateful for that. But any kind of an accident, I don't want to see. Even if they crunch up a car, that costs money, or if a fella even hurts himself just a little bit, I just don't want to see it.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever in personal danger on a first lap accident, such as 73 and 66?
No, I wasn't worried about myself. I just did a job. I don't look back down the track. I look toward the way they're coming, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never really worried about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mike, there's a cruel irony in that clip, because that aired on May the 11th of 1982, and 4 days after that, of course, one of the most infamous days in recent, when I say recent, I mean post-war, let's say, IMS history.
Yeah, that's correct. That did air on May 11th, and Gilles Villeneuve, Jacques Villeneuve's father, had died just 3 days before that aired, and so he died on May 8th. Of 1982, and we lost Gordon Smiley on May 15th. So it was very poignant to me when I was listening to that the caller calls in and said, you know, I'm so proud that we haven't had any kind of fatality here since 1973. And then literally 4 days later, we had the Gordon Smiley accident. So that really hit home with me, and I was honestly really touched by that situation.
It's almost eerie, to be honest with you.
Very eerie.
To hear that.
Very eerie.
You know, you might know this about Pat Vidan. Not only did he wave the flags over the cars, he actually painted some of them, too. He explained that as well to Kevin Calabro.
Back at the Talk from Gasoline Alley, Pat Vidan is our guest. And, Pat, we were just talking about your situation right now in Oregon, and it's back to painting again, huh?
Yeah.
And working on boats specifically.
Well, as many as I can get.
And race cars and the whole thing.
No.
Have you done any race cars out here at all ever?
Oh, yeah. When I first came here, I lettered up quite a few of them.
Yeah. You were the letterman then, huh?
Well, in a sense. George Gruber and I seemed to, he did more than I did, of course, but I did some of them.
And you worked as the flagman as well?
No, well, that's when I was assistant to Vandewater, but it was something to do, and I had fun.
Master of all out here, huh?
Well, I don't know.
Have you ever given a shot at driving?
Well, I raced motorcycles.
Mm-hmm. But the four-wheel
No, I never.
Variety.
Well, I did one time. I got into a car, and the driver didn't show up. And I went around. I thought I was doing pretty good. But I pulled into the pits, and the driver showed up. And I said, well, it's your ride, so you take it. He got into it. I went back to the flags. And he come down, I let him have several laps to warm up, and he come down the chute, and I waved the green, and he kept right on going, went out through the fence, so I figured, well, somebody's trying to tell me something.
Oh, that's terrible.
And, well, he wasn't hurt, thank God for that, but I still thought, well, I got the message, God, and forget it, you know.
But the motorcycle racing was something you started, was it you, something you started when you were earlier, or younger?
Yeah, before that, and I was running on a track, and I came off of close to the fence one day, and I started thinking. I said, now, if I win this thing, I get $5. It's not worth it. So I start running smaller tracks.
Good thought.
Yeah.
Good thought. Good thinking, Pat.
Mike, when you think about the flags up in the flag stand and you see them up there, you probably just think they're kind of sitting there like umbrellas in an umbrella stand. But the reality is there was a little more intricacy to that.
Yeah, I actually never gave this any thought until I clipped this clip. I just thought the same thing you did, that the flags just sit there in the flag stand and there's really no rhyme or reason to it. But Pat Vidan was very, very particular about what order what flag was in. And I didn't know that until he said this in this clip. I thought this was pretty fascinating, actually.
I have a certain way to put the flags in. I put the green one first, then the white, then the checkered, then the passing flag. And then I start from the other end. I have the yellow, then the red, then the black.
Mm.
Now, the reason I do that is when you start a race, you go green one more lap to go. You hope that you'll only use those three flags, because if you only use those three, you know you've got a safe race. But if you have to, something happens and you have to go for the yellow, you don't have to even look. You grab and you know it's the last one.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the next one is a red. that nobody wants to wave because that means that we have a problem. But green, as you know, means track is clear, you're on your way. White, you have one more lap to go before you get to checkered. And the checkered, we all understand what that is. The blue with the orange diagonal stripe tells a man he is being lapped. Now, it doesn't tell him to move over. It just tells him, don't take up the whole track. Keep in your groove and they'll go around you. And then the black, of course, that's another one I didn't like to wave because it brought a man in the pit. Not for a rule infraction, but generally it's something the matter with a car. And the red, as I said earlier, that I just don't like to wave it. If I have to wave it, I'd like to see it because of rain, not an accident.
Yes.
And the yellow tells them to look ahead and not pass.
When we come back, it would often be the case, in particular with Bob Jenkins, where you would hear the name of the flagman at the end of the race, symbolizing the checkered flags were coming out. One of those that was a more famous name is one we will feature next, Dwayne Sweeney, when we continue here on Beyond the Break.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
In Indy, this is the weekend summer really starts. And at Sullivan's, we're taking an additional 10% off all premium patio furniture and 20% off umbrellas. So, get ready for summer at Sullivan's.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Hey, buddy, what's the matter? You look like you're on your last breath.
I am. I've been walking for days now. I'm practicing for race day.
Race day? You in a walkathon?
No. I'm talking about the Indianapolis 500 race. I always practice walking days ahead of time because I know come race day, I'm going to have to park way out in the boondocks. It usually takes me hours to walk from where I park to the race. Heck, one year I parked so far away I missed the whole race.
You haven't heard about West Side Parking?
They
have 7 acres of campgrounds immediately west of the start finish line on the main straightaway. It's literally only a few seconds walk from gates 5, 6, and 7.
Yeah, but I bet it'll be a mess trying to get there on race day with all of the traffic.
Yeah. No, you call West Side Parking ahead of time to make reservations.
Oh.
That way they'll give you directions along a special traffic route so you'll arrive on time.
Huh.
Of course, you could do what I do.
What's that?
I spend the whole race weekend there.
Oh.
Here, I'll give you their number. You got a pencil?
Are you kidding?
Well, try to remember this number. Mm-hmm. 244-1064. Mm-hmm. That's 244-1064.
Thanks.
West Side Parking. Walking sure beats the heck out of walking.
Huh?
Walking.
Huh?
Walking.
The night before the 500, live under the stars, this Saturday night, 7:30 at the Sports Complex downtown.
Hellfire.
It's the fabulous Oak Ridge Boys in concert.
Hellfire. Primo.
The Oak Ridge Boys and Doug Hagan live in person outdoors under the stars. Tickets now on sale at Ross and Babcock downtown and Indianapolis Air's locations. Prices are $7.50, $8.50, and $9.50. Get your $1 off discount coupons now at Guarantee Auto Stores. Don't miss this one. Brought to you by the promotion company.
Elvira.
We are inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley. Mike, I can only imagine the conundrum that is created when one parks at Westside Parking for the entire weekend and then realizes they now have to walk to the Oak Ridge Boys concert, right?
That would be a conundrum. I want to point out, by the way, I believe the promotion company is still in business. That commercial was from 1981, and they're still in business. So good on the promotion company right there.
Well, they made sure that everybody also wrote down 244-1064, right?
That's right.
You have your pencil.
We do need to do a quick disclaimer. And the disclaimer is that the Oak Ridge Boys are not live in concert on Saturday night downtown. So do not go downtown for a concert Saturday night for the Oak Ridge Boys. I don't want to get calls on Monday about this.
If you've got your $20 in your pocket, you do not get two tickets and a $5 bill back to go see the Oak Ridge Boys, right?
That's correct. I mean, because I can imagine Monday you're sitting down to do Query and Company, and all of a sudden the phones start lighting up, and they say, hey, we listened to Beyond the Bricks the other night, and you said the Oak Ridge Boys were coming on Saturday night. What gives, man?
Or that same poor guy is walking around aimlessly looking for LS Airs, right? That also, we need to make sure that people are aware here, right?
That's right. There are important disclaimers on Beyond the Bricks.
I will tell you, however, it was not Elvira that I met, but my girlfriend Shannon was working at Ross and Babcock Travel when we first met one another. So there you go, right?
There you go.
All right, we're taking a look back at some of the starters for the Indianapolis 500-mile race over the years. And Bob Jenkins, I can still hear the late, great Bob Jenkins in my head. I can still hear it. Dwayne Sweeney waves the white flag in 1992, for example. Dwayne Sweeney is one of those that would take over the position of chief starter after Pat Vedan would vacate it. Here is Donald Davidson on the career of Dwayne Sweeney.
Dwayne was from Wisconsin. I want to say New Berlin, and I don't know that that was it. But anyway, he was from Wisconsin and flagged for years before he got to the Indianapolis Speedway. And he did a lot of short tracks and also did the Milwaukee Stock Cars for years. And actually, it's Dwayne who replaced Pat Vedan, who flagged for the last time in 1979. And so Dwayne did it every year from 1980 until, I think, 1995 or 96. I know it was around the time of the IRL. And when Tom Binford, at the same time, Tom Binford said that he was not going to continue as chief steward after 18 or 19 years or whatever it is. I have to count it up on my fingers. And Keith Ward was made the chief steward. It was around that time, I think, that Dwayne stepped down. But he was really good, a lot like Pat Vedan, a different approach, but he would do hospitals and go and give talks at the school, and would dress up in his outfit and take the flags and tell the kids what all the flags meant. And was great at going to fan clubs. And golly, I don't know how many races that he flagged, but just a very down-to-earth guy. And good man.
You know, Mike, Dwayne Sweeney is one of those that, and as I mentioned, there are so many names, historically speaking, but then it starts to bridge into and connecting different eras. And Dwayne Sweeney is one that does have connection to the current era at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Yeah, I believe that's correct. I believe that Dwayne Sweeney is the mentor of our current flagman, Aaron Likens. I believe that Aaron gives a lot of credit to Dwayne Sweeney as kind of a mentor. So you're right. There's a lot of bridging the gap in all these different eras, and they cross over for all of these chief starters.
Now, we do have one more flagman to talk about, and he has one of the most fascinating stories when it comes to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Talking about Howdy Wilcox II. He finished second in his only Indy 500 start. He later lost his life as a flagman. Donald Davidson on the sad end of the career and the life of Howdy Wilcox II.
Then in 33, he came back to drive for Joe Marks, qualified a car on the outside of the second row, and then there was a situation during practice. It was after qualifying and just before the race. There was Louis Schneider had a sponsor named Edelweiss, and it was a beer, and they brought some into the garage area, and Howdy Wilcox collapsed, and it turns out that he was diabetic and had been for years. And the others knew about it, and he drank a beer or two, and it had a negative reaction. So several of the drivers that knew about this immediately went into action and started stuffing candy down his throat because they were at a thing called Tom Beale's Diner when this happened. Well, the word quickly got around, and a doctor made the statement that he wouldn't be allowed to drive because he suffered from epileptic fits, which he did not. He was diabetic, but he had kept it a secret. Now, you were not allowed to drive if you were diabetic, but he'd hid that. He'd also hidden the fact that due to an accident that he had, he'd lost the sight in one eye. So when he finished second in 1932, he had sight in one eye, and he was diabetic. So they ruled that he couldn't run, and he was very, very popular, so the other drivers said, we want him in the race. So they went around over a day or two period. period and got signatures from all of the other drivers, including an Argentinian named Juan Godino and Raul Raganti, that I don't even know if they knew who Harry Wilcox was, but everybody signed, and then they came, and it was quite a job because there was 42 starters that year, so they had to get 41 signatures, which they got. And then on race morning, they presented it to the chief steward, Eddie Edinburgh, and said, basically, we want Howdy Wilcox to run. So he turned it down. Things got nasty, and then Rickenbacker got in the act, and he basically said, look, Howdy Wilcox is not fit to run. My doctor tells me that. I'm not a doctor, but I'm not going to overrule what my doctor has told me, so it stands, and we're going to have a race, even if we only have one car and I'm driving it. So we're going to start in 15 minutes, and you fellows decide whether there's a future for the Indianapolis 500 or not, and maybe we'll just not have any more. So anyway, there was a lot of grumbling, and then the other thing that happened was that Maury Rose, who had not yet driven in the 500, he'd been there the year before and this year, hadn't qualified, and they put him in as a sub. Well, that was okay, except that they were going to start him in the number six position, outside second row. So a lot of the drivers behind protested about that, even though Harry Wilcox had won two championship races so far, but he never run at the speedway. And they got around it by moving him to the back. But instead of moving everybody up a position, they simply pulled him out of the outside second row, pushed him to the back, and the outside flank moved forward one. So if you'd earned 12th starting position, you started ninth.
Wow.
And so the race started. Maury Rose came all the way from 42nd to, I think, 4th, and then dropped out. And then Howdy Wilcox the second sued the track, and the thing went to trial in June, right after the 35 500, and there was a judgment against the Speedway. I think he sued for $100,000, and he settled for $42,000, but the thing drug on, and I think he ended up getting like $3,000 or something.
Yeah.
But anyway, he stayed in the area and was involved in several other racing associations, and then he lost his life in 1946. He was flagging a race up in Converse, Indiana, which is up a little bit east of Kokomo, and it was a very dusty track, and he was out there on the track flagging, and he got hit by a car.
One of the interesting anecdotes of that, obviously, Mike, is the fact that Maury Rose himself would go on to become a three-time winner of the race, and that, I think, is the part of that story that I've always found fascinating. In addition to that, it is my belief, now I'm not saying this concretely, but Mike, I believe I'm correct in this. Maury Rose is the only starter of the Indianapolis 500 that did not have to go through any sort of a rookie orientation or clearance prior to getting in the car because of those unusual circumstances.
I believe that is correct. It was a strange situation, and as Donald points out, they did get everybody to sign this petition, and Rickenbacker did say, basically, well, I'm going to run some laps and you can either join me or not, but we're going to still have a race. And it was a strange scenario that cropped up that year, but I believe you're correct. I think that they put Maury Rose in the car, and he had, people knew Maury Rose, they knew he was a capable driver, but it was an unusual set of circumstances. And one thing that we have to point out is Howard Wilcox II, that is a different person than Howdy Wilcox Jr. Howdy Wilcox Jr. was the son of the winner of the race, the early winner, the Howdy Wilcox who won the race. Howdy Wilcox Jr., his son, is the person who created the Little 500 down at Indiana University, the famous bike race. But these are two different people completely. So sometimes people get confused about that. Howdy Wilcox, the winner, and Howard Wilcox, the second, they were not related in any way. And Donald doesn't even believe they ever even met.
And I believe that the second became, and I could be wrong in this, the kind of almost like a nickname that was used to differentiate for fans from the winner, Howdy Wilcox, although there may have been familial ties to that as well. All right, we've saved the best for last. We've basically done like Bobby Rahal, 1986, won the race with the fastest lap on the last lap of the race. This is the penultimate show for this season of Beyond the Bricks. And tomorrow night, Mike, it's potpourri night, and that means the very best of audio clips. And tomorrow night, we're going to close it out and finish it strong. And I know that you are going to bring the heat, as the kids say. I look forward to it tomorrow night, Mike, but a lot of fun again tonight.
Oh, yeah, we're bringing the heat tomorrow. Be ready for tomorrow's show. There's some special stuff tomorrow.
Appreciate everyone listening to Beyond the Bricks.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Hey, what's up, guys? I'm Jade Warshaw, and I co-host The Ramsey Show. Now, whether you're buying a house or planning for your kid's future or just trying to figure out what to do with your money before life figures it out for you, The Ramsey Show is going to be your new favorite show. You'll hear real people call in with real money questions and, let's be honest, sometimes some real drama. But we're here for it. We help them take control and make a plan for their money, and we can help you too. Start watching on YouTube or search The Ramsey Show wherever you listen to podcasts.